Next case of the day, which is State versus Wolf. Mr. Green, good morning to you, but before you begin, we have folks coming in out of the court. Ms. Osborne, you are also here. Do either council have any questions before we begin?
Not for the talk.
Then, Mr. Green, you may proceed.
Kelly Green, the Nebraska Commission on Public Advocacy, on behalf of Gregory Moore, the appellant in the case. This involves the motion to discharge filed by the defendant, filed more than 6 months after the filing of the information in the case. The circumstances were, Moore appeared for a preliminary hearing in county court on the charges of second-degree murder and abuse. Case was bound to district court by the county court, who set the arraignment date for 2 days later. This is Gary, Nebraska. We office in Lincoln. Knowing that I could submit a written not guilty plea in district court, I decided that that was better than the commission undertaking a three-night stay in Gary for a simple arraignment. So I went back to my office and I drafted a document pursuant to 294206, which was a written not guilty plea, and waiver of appearance. At that time, I also prepared a proposed order because in my motion to continue the arraignment date of December 18, I requested the court set the matter for a status hearing because I wanted a date certain. Why is a date certain important? A date certain is important always because otherwise you make a motion for a continuance and you don't tell the court what you want to continue to, you've continued it to infinity. The court received my motion for continuance. The written not guilty plea and waiver of appearance was in the mail to the client to sign. And the court received my motion for continuance and then did something very curious. She crossed out the blank side left to fill in a date on the proposed order of a status hearing in February. And instead, she wrote a date certain into her order. And that date certain was December 31st, 2021. That was the date we were to appear for arraignment. If we didn't file with the court within 2 weeks a written not guilty plea. Those were the dates certain. The date I file a written not guilty plea, the date there's going to be an arraignment if I don't file a written not guilty plea. Well, the written not guilty plea got filed December 23rd. No hearing.
Did you make any inquiry of the court of setting a new trial? A new hearing date?
No, Your Honor. What I wanted to accomplish was accomplished. A written not guilty. She allowed me. Well, later she rules that she never accepted our not guilty plea. She creates it into a nullity that has no force and effect, even though she signed that order. If you look at section 294206 of the requirements for a written not guilty plea, you can compare it with Exhibit 2, the written not guilty plea, you see it follows the statutory guidelines for filing a written not guilty plea. There's no action necessary for the court. The statute says the court shall accept. If it's in the form of the statute, the court shall accept the not guilty plea.
How many days, if any, should have been counted against your client for your argument here?
For my argument, the days that I felt were excluded were from the date of the filing of the information, because I filed my motion for continuance immediately. So the clock hadn't started and continued to December 23rd when I filed the written not guilty plea.
Mr. Breen, you said that the
statute... That's 6 days, I believe.
I'm sorry. You said that the statute says shall, not may, but doesn't the statute, in fact, in the first sentence of subsection 1 say that county courts and district courts may accept a written waiver of preliminary hearing and a written waiver of arraignment and plea of not guilty?
Well, I believe if you have practiced in the courts,
so
I have never seen a written not guilty plea that follows the form of 29-4206 not accepted, and I think that counsel should receive some notice from the court if they're not going to accept a written not guilty plea.
You represented to us a moment ago that the statute says shall, but I just quoted from the first sentence where it says...
And I'm wrong in that first sentence, but I think that the plain intent of the statute isn't to place discretion with the judge as to whether written not guilty pleas can be used in court. I don't think that the district court has discretion, and if she had discretion, she permitted me to file such written not guilty plea by her order that was issued on December 18th. She said, file a written not guilty plea or appear for arraignment on New Year's Eve. I filed a written not guilty plea on December 23rd, never heard anything from the court regarding acceptance of a plea, a written not guilty plea, until after the hearing, the evidentiary hearing on the motion to discharge.
I'd like to ask you a quick question. There was a second case referenced here that had a competency stand trial going on. Were you the attorney on that case as well?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, so that's not anything you're there. I have a couple of hypotheticals I'd like to ask you. And before I start the hypotheticals, I want to point out that I don't mean these hypotheticals to imply any wrongdoing or unethical behavior on your part in any manner. Okay? But if a defense attorney would have been in a position such as you were here, do they have any duty to inform the court that the speedy trial clock is running out?
They have a duty to their client to represent them zealously, then I think would counsel against that.
Now, with the way the system's set up since Alvarez, actually the incentives here are to not inform the court because that can benefit the client in receiving a discharge, isn't it?
They have a statutory right to be tried within 6 months. It is the state's burden.
Well, Alvarez says the state is defined as the courts and the prosecution, so.
Well, I'm not asking the court to reverse Alvarez here.
I didn't think you would.
I am here stating that I don't think I have any ethical duty to raise speedy trial issues to the court until I feel that it can be of benefit to my client.
Okay, and I'm not asserting otherwise. Is there anything that would prevent a defense attorney from preserving their client's speedy trial right by asserting it ahead of time to say, Your Honor, you're running out of time, and my client's speedy trial clock is running out. He's entitled to have this trial before 6 months, and I'd like you to set it. Or would that actually be a basis for possibly an ineffective assistance of counsel claim?
I think it would be a basis for an ineffective assistance of counsel. Douglas County District Court, one of the first cases I tried, they were running up to the speedy trial clock. The judge sent the sheriff out to bring Veneerman in to pick a jury, and we were going to pick a jury. And it was the state that requested a continuance at that point, because they didn't want a jury that was taken from the gathering of Veneerman by the sheriff.
Your time is dwindling, and I do want to ask, there was another ground upon which the district court overruled your motion for discharge. And I understand that you disagree with both grounds advanced by the district court. What my question, however, is the time periods, it looks to me like, overlap between both grounds. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
And if either one of the grounds is sufficient, we don't need to address the other ground at all, right?
Judge, that would be correct.
Okay. And as but I would, say...
But that other ground that we haven't talked about is huge, because
that's your
what
time.
They're saying in that case is that you, that a competency proceeding in another case controlled the speedy trial of a case unrelated to it.
Well, your client was determined to be incompetent to stand trial in the other case. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And I know you weren't representing him in that case. How is the trial court to deal with that in a separate case? They know that the defendant's not competent to stand trial in the one case. How does that bleed over, if at all, to this case? And is there a burden on the state to file a new competency determination?
I don't see how.
Well, if you're not competent to stand trial, you're not competent to stand trial either case, are you?
I don't believe so, because I think, and I assert this in the brief, I think it's a mixed question of law and medicine. Psychologists and psychiatrists are not there to go into they're there to go into Guadney and ask those questions and see how the defendant answers the questions about the function of the court, the function of the judge, the function of the jury, the function of the participants, questions about unjust punishment, questions about whether they can elicit the facts in the case such that they can confer with counsel and confer with counsel both on strategy and upon what the facts are. Important inquiries, but all inquiries that a psychiatrist wouldn't do if he was just evaluating this person to determine a mental disability. Well, I can't intervene in that case. I don't agree with that doctor. I would have had the opportunity to ask the court for another doctor if they'd instituted competent proceedings to assert my client's competency to stand trial. Because I do believe that. And I do believe that different cases, a person that's facing a prosecution with complex evidence like DNA could stand trial for resisting arrest in county court.
Was there anything to prevent you from requesting a hearing in this case on competency?
I didn't have a basis to, because my client was laying down a rational defense to me, which I investigated. When I investigated, I found out that a lot of what my client had to tell me was true.
Wasn't he in the regional center?
Well, he was in the regional center, but he appeared for the status hearing that the state requested in this case in July 14th, and he was appeared by Zoom from the regional center for the evidentiary hearing in this case. And it was simply a matter of inconvenience to transport him for the evidentiary hearing that was done like that. He was available. He was available at all times. He appeared three times in this case, at the preliminary hearing, at the status hearing on July 14th, and at the evidentiary hearing
That doesn't make him competent, because he appeared.
No, it doesn't make him competent, but it makes him available.
Can he understand the proceedings, the roles of the trial attorney, the judge, the witnesses? Can he assist in his defense? All those factors would have to be considered, wouldn't they?
Well, they'd have to be considered, but they're considered in the context of the case.
So
it stands as a general order against this defendant having a trial in any other case that he has.
Is your proposition you could be competent in one case and not competent in another, depending on the allegations?
I think that is the case.
If you run a red light, that's one thing. But it says it's complex murder, that's another thing.
Yes.
Did you assert to the court that your client was competent before you claimed that the court erred in not setting the trial date?
Judge, I asserted that. I offered Exhibits 5, 6, and 7 to demonstrate that the alleged victim in this case had been investigated by the police in other circumstances, violations of protection order.
You know, just not the rest of the evidence, just the competency issue is all I meant. I'm sorry.
That went to the competency issue, Judge, because I wanted to show to the court, I asserted to the court that I had done an inquiry using the case of State versus Watney to go through factors to determine his competency. I also wanted to indicate to the court that we had listened to his defense and we'd actually investigated his defense and we found evidence to support self-defense. It's in the probable cause affidavit for his arrest. This happens, this crime happens at his house. The alleged victim is not a resident of that apartment. Never even lived in the building. That fifth alleged victim has gone to other people's houses and refused their request that he leave and has been belligerent and violent and violated protection orders. That comes in as provocation, I understand, in self-defense cases.
Thank you.
Evidence of that. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you very much. Ms. Osborne, good morning to you.
Hey, police the court. I'm Jordan Osborne, Assistant Attorney General, representing the appellee in the state of Nebraska. So I'll start, I think the primary issue here is what was just being discussed by the court and what the state focused on in the brief, is that whether a judicial finding that a defendant is incompetent to stand trial in a separate case establishes an excludable period under the speedy trial statute. So in 29-1207-4A, the speedy trial statute specifically refers to examinations and hearings on competency and the period during which a defendant is incompetent to stand trial, being periods of delay resulting from other proceedings concerning the defendant that are excludable for purposes of statutory speedy trial. And it's obviously well established that when that type of finding, a finding of incompetency, occurs in the case before the court, that is that establishes an excludable period under 29-1207-4A. So the question here is, what effect does that exact same judicial finding that a defendant is incompetent to stand trial has when it occurs in a separate case? And in this situation, what we had, both of these cases were before the exact same district court judge, same prosecuting county attorney's office. What was in that separate case where the defendant was found incompetent to stand trial. So both the U.S. Supreme Court and Nebraska statute holds that subjecting an incompetent defendant to trial violates due process. So for the period of time that the appellant was deemed incompetent to stand trial, which included the entire period from the filing of the information all the way through the filing of the motion to discharge, in this case, the state was constitutionally and statutorily barred from bringing the appellant
to trial. So is the statute about availability to be at court proceedings and make appearances in a particular case, or is your argument that the incompetency determination in one case is really an incompetency determination in two cases?
Well, the state's argument is under both 29-1207-4A, which is the incompetency finding, the fact that he's incompetent to stand trial, but that same finding also applies to 29-1207-4D for unavailability. And the appellant talked about...
Isn't your 4A argument a textual one that simply says a period of delay resulting from other proceedings concerning the defendant, including but not limited to, and then a whole list of things, one of which is competency, but another one of which is the time consumed in the trial of other charges. And the other charges item in the list is clearly something that's in a different case, right?
Correct. And this court has already stated in State versus Blocker that 29-1207-4A applies to proceedings in the pending case as well as proceedings in other pending cases. And we know that that has to be the case because of that last line about proceedings concerning a defendant, other proceedings concerning a defendant that are the time consumed in the trial of other charges against the defendant, which has to happen in a separate case. So the statutory language, I guess what I'm getting at here is there's statutory interpretation component to this, that the principle of statutory interpretation, appellate courts must give the statutory language its plain ordinary meaning, cannot read meaning into a statute that's not warranted by the legislative language or read anything plain, direct, or unambiguous out of a statute.
So I beg your pardon. Tying the discussion to the statutes, is your argument if you're incompetent in one case, that finding with respect to a second unrelated case is not that you've become incompetent in case number two, but rather you are in carrying the baggage of time consumed in another case?
Well, I guess
not incompetent in both cases. Incompetent in case one, but in case number two, that the effect of the first is time consumed in another case.
I would argue that the effect of the finding in the first case that he's incompetent to stand trial is another proceeding concerning the defendant that involves the fact that he's been found incompetent and he is incompetent to stand trial. It comes under that first portion of that subsection 4A.
Does it follow he's incompetent in case two?
Well, he's incompetent in case two for the purposes of the exclusionary time period under 29-1207.
So he's not incompetent in case two, he's just busy and therefore time consumed elsewhere.
And in regard to busy, is it factually accurate that he was in the regional center in Lincoln, Nebraska?
For a period of the time that we're talking about, yes, he was at the regional center receiving restoration of competency treatment. So
is your argument he couldn't be in court in Scotts Bluff during that period of time?
So the appellant makes an argument that he's in the state's custody in the present case, that he could have been transported from the regional center, but I think that totally misses the point of especially 29-1207-4D for his unavailability. He's unavailable because he's incompetent, not because of his physical location. He couldn't be tried. He could be sitting in the district courtroom in Scottsbluff County, ready to go to trial, but he's still unavailable because he can't be tried. He's incompetent to stand trial. So his physical location really is irrelevant, I think, to the 4D analysis. He is still unavailable, and this court has already stated that 1207-4D is typically applied when somebody is fails to appear, so they've made themselves absent. But that's not required by the language of the statute.
Is it possible for a defendant to be incompetent for purposes of one proceeding but competent for purposes of another?
I think if the district court is making a factual finding that you're incompetent in this case, so in the one case, so you're incompetent in another case, which is exactly what happened in this case, I think that is the case.
What if, hypothetically, what if two judges were involved instead of the same judge?
So hypothetically, you could have a situation, I think this has happened in Nebraska before, where a defendant was found incompetent in one county and he had charges in some other county with a different judge, and that judge, nothing was brought before that judge to make them aware that this other incompetency finding had occurred. The defendant pleads guilty to something in that other county, and then on appeal wants to say, well, that should not be a proper conviction because I was incompetent over here. I think the appellate courts in Nebraska have said that, well, you didn't make that district court judge aware, and there's nothing in the plea colloquy to make the court aware that you are incompetent to stand trial. So in that situation, that conviction wasn't overturned. So I think hypothetically or theoretically, a person could be at least legally or under an appellate standard of review, conviction might not be reversed when you have two proceedings going on at the same time. But in that particular situation, that other judge was not aware.
If in the second case, the second judge is made aware of the first case's finding, what's up?
Well, I think that the second judge has to make a factual finding as to whether the person is incompetent. And I think it was alluded to in the appellant's argument that, did you have the ability to bring a motion before the court and say, I don't think this finding is correct in this other case. I think my client is competent. The appellant certainly could have brought a motion and said, I want another expert to evaluate my client. I think he's competent in this case. And that never happened here. The district court judge here made a factual finding that he was not competent. At the discharge hearing.
Which of your two text-based arguments do you think is stronger, your 4A argument or your 4D argument?
Well, I guess as I've reviewed this, I really find it virtually impossible to see how is he not unavailable. To me, it just seems like there isn't any way that you could say that when the district court has made a factual finding that not only in the other case, they've made the factual finding in the other case is incompetent, but in this case, after the discharge hearing, the district court makes the factual finding that not only is he was he found incompetent in that other case for the exact same time period, but that he's still incompetent after he filed his motion for discharge.
What's the evidence upon which the judge in this case, I'll call it the second case, decided he was incompetent in this particular second case?
At the discharge hearing, there were several exhibits offered. We have in the Bill of Exceptions, there's both evaluations. You have the original competency
evaluation.
From case number one.
Was that 2249?
Okay. Correct. And then you have the second competency evaluation from the regional center. You have both clinical psychologists, two different people finding him not competent to stand trial. In that second evaluation was dated 5 days before he filed his motion for discharge. The hearing occurred after he filed his motion for discharge, and the court found him still. He was not competent at that point in time. So, and that's a factual finding that the court made in its order on the motion for discharge. So I think both arguments are textually sound. I just don't see how someone could be not unavailable when they can't be tried.
I have permission from the chief to ask an additional question. Going back to the beginning portion of Mr. Breen's argument about this order that came out where maybe or maybe not, it says if you do this, then this happens, and if this happens, another thing right. happens. Could you speak to that? Is it a conditional order? I don't even know how to pose the question.
Let me throw in on top of that, because I wanted to ask along the same lines. Your brief does not argue about this other ground. What are we to make of that? You can deal with both questions.
Okay, so the short answer is I'm not sure whether that ground under 29-1207-4B, which was she made it under 4B and 4F, which is based on the court's indefinite continuance finding, actually is excludable time. But ultimately, I think as was stated earlier, I don't think the court needs to even address it because I think it's well established under 4A and 4D. But the long answer would be that, and I think some of this was discussed during the appellant's argument, that the statute 29-4206 discusses written waivers of arraignment, pleas of not guilty, and it states that the district courts may accept such a filing, which implies that the court must do something to accept it and that it's discretionary on the court because it says may, not shall. So in this court, we know that the district court sent out this order saying either file your written waiver arraignment, plead him not guilty, or appear on this date and time for arraignment. He filed timely. He filed his written waiver, plea not guilty, but the court didn't respond to it. So as far as I know, I don't believe this court has ever spoken to whether a district court...
Should the court have responded and said, I'm not accepting your written...
In my experience, the courts, I don't think I've ever seen a situation where a court didn't respond to a written waiver and plead not guilty. I think usually a court will send out almost like a sort of boilerplate order that says, the defendant has filed this, I accept the plea of not guilty, not guilty plea is entered, pretrial is set for whatever date and time. The court, for whatever reason, which is our record is totally silent as to why, didn't respond one way or the other. There's no response at all. So I think it would be up to this court to determine whether an acceptance is required, and then if it is, and that is not forthcoming, does that establish an indefinite continuance in this type of situation where we know that the statute says that a defendant who has sought and obtained a continuance, which is indefinite, has an affirmative duty to end the continuance. So,
is it tenable to have this sort of casual relationship with guilty, not guilty? That shouldn't the defendant know where he, she stands? Shouldn't the court know where he, she stands? Shouldn't the state know?
Right. I mean,
where are we in the proceedings?
I guess I'm not. If I'm understanding your question, should the court ever, should there ever be a situation where if a defendant is asserting a not guilty, the court says no, I don't accept that? Is that your? I'm not sure if I understand.
But that would be easy. I'm without a ruling. One has to, I believe, surmise on the basis of this order and the record that must have been what happened, not accepted.
I don't know that, as far as I'm aware, I don't think this court has ever said whether the court has to affirmatively do something to accept a plea, whether it's in person or whether it's by a written or written motion. And so I think to resolve that particular subsection and whether that's an excludable period, I think the court would first have to make a comment on that. Whether
we have to have a ruling to count days.
Right. Whether a ruling is necessary. Is this an indefinite continuance without the ruling? Or is it not? And I think because this is sort of an unusual factual situation, I don't know the answer to that question, which is why I focused on the other subsections, because I think those subsections are much more clear based on this court's prior rulings and the statutory interpretation. Unless there are further questions, I'd ask that you affirm.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for a rebuttal? There is no time for a rebuttal. Thank you very much.